Joe Clement will now read from Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy, and how we can understand the green economy.
Last week, Tom Becker read an article about the pitfalls and perhaps inevitability of techno fixes for dealing with climate change, which made me want to share an excerpt from a book that I've been reading by Allison Hope Alcon. The book's called Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. The particular section from Chapter 2 on Understanding the Green Economy that I want to read describes the co-optation or the shift in environmentalist rhetoric and cachet and practice in the 1970s for one that was critical of capitalism and called for its constraint at the very least, if not sometimes its full-on abolition, to one that takes the capitalist economy and the market for granted as natural. In 1972, a groundbreaking study called The Limits to Growth modeled the effects of increases in population growth and resource consumption on ecological health. It concluded that if current trends continued, they would lead to, quote, overshoot and collapse, end quote, in which human societies could no longer provide for themselves. This influential report lent credence to two approaches to global development. One was the Malthusian argument against population growth, which had become popular among wealthy countries with already low growth rates. Emphasizing population without regard for consumption, however, places the burden of environmental problems entirely on the global south. Many activists seeking to preserve the natural world and increase social equity supported a second approach, zero economic growth or steady state economics. In contrast to macroeconomic policies commonly designed to produce growth, steady-state systems aim for equilibrium, or for slight fluctuations, in both population and production. According to ecological economists like Herman Daly, a steady-state economy does not excessively disrupt natural ecosystems and can protect natural resources. The limits to growth argument was highly controversial. Among its most prominent critics was Columbia University economist Jagdish Bhagwati. In a widely read article in Scientific American from 1993, Bhagwati argued that economic growth would protect the environment, as profits garnered could be taxed and used for the abatement of pollution and for general remediation. To support this position, he pointed to the high numbers of environmental organizations in developed countries with high economic growth, arguing that growth is good for the environmental movement and hence good for the environment itself. Extending his argument in 2009, Bhagwati accounts for social goods as well, arguing that, quote, firms that make losses can't finance corporate social responsibility policies, end quote. Present-day proponents of the green economy similarly argue that economic growth leads to environmental protection. The idea that there were environmental limits to economic growth greatly influenced the U.S. environmental movement in the 1970s, which departed from its preservationist predecessor to advocate state cleanup and control of pollution. Under pressure from the environmental movement, the federal government passed legislation that would constrain profits, reflecting a popular belief that environmental and human health limits to economic growth were sometimes necessary. At the same time, more radical environmentalists developed currents of environmental theory and practice that offered implicit and explicit critiques of industrial culture and sometimes of capitalism itself. Eco-socialists, eco-feminists, and social ecologists argued that domination of nature was a consequence of domination between people and had found its most quote-unquote exacerbating development under capitalism. Advocates of these positions called for collective ownership of the means of production and the restoration of the commons. In addition, deep ecologists, who prioritized the intrinsic worth of non-human nature, emphasized its protection over economic growth. Their best-known strategy consists of direct action tree sits, in which activists occupy land slated to be logged in order to protect it. Additionally, while a confrontation with capitalism was not always at the top of the agenda for the Back to the Land movement, it attempted to escape the cultural and economic constraints of, quote, mainstream society, end quote, through the creation of rural communes in which resources could be shared. These communes developed some of the early techniques that would enable organic farming and are an important predecessor for many today's food movements and farmers' markets. Participants in this kind of environmentalism advocated the creation of new, non-capitalist ways of being that they envisioned as close to and respectful of non-human nature. Despite their sometimes fiercely argued differences, these voices saw capitalism as something to escape from or confront if the environment and human society were to be sustained. The popularity of environmental discourses arguing for limits on capitalism, quote, came to represent a substantial and growing constraint on capitalist accumulation strategies and thus was ripe for neoliberal attacks. McCarthy and Prudhomme write in 2004 about neoliberal nature and the nature of neoliberalism. These attacks occurred in the wake of the late 1970s energy crisis, which made it difficult to argue against growth and helped propel the Reagan administration's pro-business and anti-environment agenda. In this context, the state abandoned its charge of protecting citizens from the excesses of capital, instead imagining its role as the creator of market conditions favorable to growth. In this reactionary political landscape, sustainability emerged as a discourse that could guide economic and cultural practices, fitting environmentalists' concern into a pro-growth agenda. Environmental activists began to ignore the role of capitalism in environmental degradation, paving the way for a new sustainability paradigm in which economic growth and environmental protection were seen as interdependent. If you just tuned in, I've been reading from Allison Hope Alcon's book, Black, White, and Green, subtitled Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. I thought that I would pair that with one of my favorite songs from the 2012 Lorax movie because of the way that it lays bare the logic of the pro-growth agenda, as Allison Hope Alcon puts it, that is behind the marriage between sustainability and capitalism. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. How bad can I be? I'm just following my destiny. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. How bad can I be? How bad can I possibly be? Well, there's a principle in nature that almost every creature knows, called survival of the fittest. And check it, this is how it goes. The animal that wins gotta scratch and fight and claw and bite and punch. And the animal that doesn't, well, the animal that doesn't winds up someone else's. La 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 la. It sound. It says the people with the money, make this ever-loving world go round. So I'm bigger in my company, I'm bigger in my factory, I'm bigger in my corporate sign. Everybody out there, take care of yours and me. I'll take care of mine, 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 mine. Shake that bottom line.